This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. In her latest book, Lost Science, Astonishing Tales of Forgotten Genius, Kitty Ferguson uncovers the story of scientists and their achievements that have been all but ignored in scientific literature. She spoke with us about lost science and how she researched the stories of the men and women who contributed so much, yet receive so little recognition today. Kitty, thank you for joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
You've written so many books about science. I think you have a total of 8 that you've written. How did this particular book come to be?
Well, this book, which is unusual for me, was actually suggested by somebody else. I was invited to write this book and found the invitation was to write a book of unknown stories from the history of science. And you might well imagine that my first reaction was, if they are unknown, how do they think I know them? So it became my job to try to find some truly unknown stories or lesser known stories, because I think there are lesser known stories that should be better known. And I live for half a year in Cambridge, England, and there are a lot of university scientists there, and I have scientific friends here in America. And so I began picking their brains, and it made good dinner conversation to ask them, you know, think about your own field. Can you give me any clues, any leads? And that's more or less where I began. Got my friend from Los Alamos, who used to work at Los Alamos, gave me a lead to Benjamin Thompson. My brother-in-law, who's a neuroscientist, gave me the lead to Barry Sternman. A friend of mine from Milutin Milankovic, the lead came from the great nephew of the polar explorer Ernest Shackleton, who I know this man, Nick Shackleton, very well at Cambridge, and he suggested that I write about Milutin Milankovic. He said he's a wonderful scientist, and he did a lot of his work from prison, and he was a very brave man, and so that's how he got in there, and various other things. I first encountered the man Ferdinand Verbeest, who is the opening story of the book, because I read that he had invented the first automobile, the first automotive machine, as he called it. And this was back in the 1600s, before any of us really think about automotive machines. Various leads like that, one thing leading to another. And I actually have a long list of people I didn't include in this book. These were kind of I tried to put together something that spanned a lot of years, from about 100 AD to the present, and would take us all over the world and be both men and women, and introduce us to a lot of passionate, interesting scientists.
You mentioned Benjamin Thompson. I thought his story was particularly intriguing. He's a spy for the British during the American Revolution. He's a scoundrel, a ruthless scoundrel. Yet he's a prolific inventor. Was he the antithesis of Benjamin Franklin?
Well, he was very much like Benjamin Franklin, because he was capable of all these wonderful little inventions, you know, a better coffee pot, a better way to insulate clothing, a fireplace that sold all over the world, his fireplace design. And, you do know that he's a scoundrel, all right, but I can't help thinking that if you've met him, you might have liked him.
Apparently,
you might be very drawn to him. Yeah.
Apparently he had a great degree of charisma from the way you describe him.
Evidently, yes. And he had, but he used people really quite disgracefully, especially women. You know, he just used them and discarded them. He became the lover of the wife of the man in Boston who was printing revolutionary newspapers, and that's how he got into to find out what this guy was printing, this Thomas. He was a scoundrel, and yet he did some good things in Munich. He set up that a factory there where people who had been formerly beggars on the streets were brought in to have jobs, be educated, have food, and manufacture uniforms. And many of those people later said, you know, he was the greatest thing in their lives. He's a very interesting man, many layered. So as I say, you don't like him, and yet you think you might have liked him.
Now, you have a favorite.
And I like his kitchen inventions. Yes.
Do you have a favorite from among all these stories, Kitty?
My favorites change by the day for different reasons.
Okay.
Every time I read one, I think, oh, that's the best one. I do like the first one, the Ferdinand Verbeest, his adventures in China in the 1600s.
That was the first automobile. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. But more importantly than that, actually, is the way the young emperor, and this is a young emperor, a 14-year-old, used that science and used that astronomy to defeat his enemies at court and become one of the most powerful emperors ever in Chinese history. And Verbeest was very much part of that story. At the same time, he was saving his own life by being able to do these experiments. And I'm reminded of the story by Mark Twain called Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Do you know that one?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
He saves his life by being able to predict an eclipse. And in this case, Verbeest was able to save his life by being able to predict just where the shadow of the sun would come at noon on three successive days. And it's a really riveting story because it was a dangerous place to be and dangerous situation, and he carried it off, much to his own surprise, actually. That's a good story.
Why is it important to point out these stories?
I don't know that it's important. I think it's fun to read about them, and it's inspiring, actually, because these were scientists of such passion, and such risk takers. I mean, this chap, Dodorosh, the way he traveled to Siberia over barely frozen ice with his big sledges, and then he went, of course, over to Mexico. He was tracing the transit of Venus back in the 1700s, and he lost his life from typhoid fever in Mexico. He knew there was typhoid fever all around. Everybody was dying, but all he wanted to do was look through his telescope, and that was it. And life began. You know, he was really and Maria Sibylla Marion. Imagine a woman in 1700 setting out by herself with her daughter across the Atlantic to Suriname in Brazil to pursue her science and her drawings there. That took an awful lot of courage.
There are just so many stories out there, like you're saying. Why have they become a lost part of science history?
Well, I think in many cases, this was science that didn't lead to other science. Now, in case of Benjamin Thompson, yes, he did undermine the caloric theory of heat, and that was important, but he was a little ahead of his time. It probably would have happened anyway. It wasn't a big discovery that was going to carry forward. Ferdinand Verbeest was dealing with he was still using a Ptolemaic or a Ptolemaic description of the cosmos rather than Copernican, which was behind his times, really. But two people really did make great contributions in my story there. One was Lisa Meitner, who was responsible for splitting the atom and did not get the Nobel Prize for it. And the other was Milutin Milankovitch, who was responsible for what's called the astronomical theory of the ice ages. And those two are very important. That is science that is ongoing, and in a way, so is Maria Sibylla Marion, with her, was really doing ecology long before there was even the name ecology. So those are not dead ends. But when you look at Verbeest and Thompson, they didn't contribute much to the ongoing history of science. So should they be forgotten? I think they shouldn't, because they're just such fun to read about.
You know, many people know Charles Darwin, or at least they're somewhat familiar with Charles Darwin and evolution. And the other one that really intrigued me was that there was another Darwin. Tell us a little bit about who he was and then what makes him the other Darwin.
Well, he was Alfred Russel Wallace, and he's one of my favorites, too, because he was such a wonderful man, really a good man, world explorer and naturalist. And he came up with what was really the theory of natural selection. He was over in the Malay Archipelago. And he sent this idea to Darwin and said, you know, maybe this would be an interesting idea and contribute to your work and be helpful. And, of course, Darwin was appalled because this was his own theory that he'd been working on for years. Now, Darwin was such a meticulous, careful scientist, and everybody was urging him, please publish this work so nobody else will beat you to it. But Darwin wasn't quite satisfied. He kept putting it off. And then when he saw this coming from Wallace, he knew he had to really publish, and he did soon after that. Wallace never made any claims that he had beat Darwin to that. He knew he hadn't. Darwin had been thinking about it for years. Or that he had any claim, you know, any priority claim, any claim to be considered or recognized like Darwin. But he did come up with that idea. And the kind of, it's an interesting story about when that letter came to Darwin. You know, this could be helpful. Well, helpful was the last word he thought of. You know, oh, my heavens, you know, here's this guy who has my same idea. But he did. And they were colleagues for a long time. They disagreed on certain things in the theory, but on the whole, Wallace was never claimed to have discovered that before Darwin. I think what I find so interesting in Wallace's story is how he did travel there in Brazil and collected all these things in the jungle. It's taking such risks. And then his ship coming back burned, and he lost it all. And that is just a tragic story and an interesting story, and says so much about the man that he just picked himself up and went on. You know, he's that kind of person.
Kepler's Near Fatal Fiction. Yes. What was that about?
Well, that's that deals with his, that was probably the first real science fiction book, which is what he wrote, called Somnium, or The Dream. It began as a student disputation, which is just a paper he wrote as a student. Then later he really expanded it to make a little book out of it. And Kepler was a brilliant man, but he was so foolish to make this story so almost autobiographical, although it couldn't be. And of course, he hadn't been to the moon, but the woman in it did so resemble his mother, and he made her out to be what many people would call a witch, and his mother was tried as a witch and did manage to escape. She didn't; she wasn't convicted.
So the neighbors read this and thought he was serious.
She was already under suspicion in many ways, but he felt guilty, I think, for the rest of his life that maybe he had caused her all this grief. Because he wrote things like this journey to the moon, in his book, was particularly possible for dried-up old crones who fly on pitchforks and goats. And then he described his mother. I mean, this was not smart.
No.
And the reason we call it the first science fiction story isn't because it's the first story about anybody going to the moon, but it is the first story that really got into the science of it.
Kitty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and I hope people will enjoy this book.
Kitty Ferguson, her latest book is Lost Science, Astonishing Tales of Forgotten Genius.